Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
And good afternoon, listeners. It is a beautiful spring day here in Fairfax, Virginia. The windows are open. There are breezes blowing through. Cherry blossoms are in full bloom. Okay, I'll confess, we survived winter. Thank God for that. Anyway, we are here today to continue something we kind of started last week. Last week, we told you the story of one of the greatest spy hunts in history. We had the incomparable Sandy Grimes, who was one of the CIA's top Soviet analysts and operators, tell us the story of her work and that of others in hunting down one of the greatest spies in American history, Alder James. It was a multi-year effort. It took a long time, and in the end, was closed out successfully. We're going to go back, though, a couple of years, about the time, in fact, Ames was just starting to spy, and talk about a slightly different spy case in a much different year. 1985 is often called by historians the year of the spy. And in truth, there was a period of time in the early 1980s, particularly 84 and 85, where we were making vast numbers of arrests for espionage. In fact, in about a five-year period, there were almost three dozen major arrests, from the Walker spy family to Ron Pelton to Edward Lee Howard. And 85 was a particularly notable year, as was the month of November 1985, because there were no less than three major mole hunts going on during that period. Now, we're going to talk about one of the more unusual ones today, because one of those spy hunts involved a spy who wasn't spying on us for China or Russia or anybody else who theoretically was an enemy. He was spying for us. He was spying on us for Israel, an ally, at least on most days. And this is the story of Jonathan and Pollard and his wife, Anne. It is an unusual case in that while most spy hunt cases last years, this one lasted but 2 weeks. And while usually it involves a multi-jurisdictional task force that has, you know, all kinds of caveats and assets on it, this one was a relatively small one and generally led by the Naval Investigative Service, the precursor to the modern-day NCIS made famous by the television show. We're going to talk to the NIS special agent who led that spy hunt. He has written a great book for Naval Institute Press called Catching Jonathan Pollard, and his name is Ronald Oliver. Ron, are you with us, sir?
Ron. Yes, I am, John. Good afternoon. How are you doing? Go ahead.
There are just days where it's too pretty to be inside, but talking to you about spy hunting, I'll do it, sir.
Well, that's great. I'm happy to be on your show and go into this crazy case.
Now, let's make this very clear. For anybody who has followed traditional spy hunting cases, the story of catching Jonathan Pollard ain't it. This is a wacky, weird, and at times almost Keystone Cops kind of situation that went on for a very short period of time, just a couple of weeks in 1985, right?
That's correct.
And first of all, before we get too far into it, I want to ask a couple of questions just so the people understand who you were then and what you were then. You are Ronald Olive, and you were a special agent for the Naval Investigative Service here in Washington, D.C., correct?
That is correct.
And what was your specialty at the time? What is it you did that made you a special agent at that time, sir?
Well, we're all special agents, you know, and we all work various felony crimes, counterintelligence, counterterrorism, special operations, which are some of the things that I did. We work double agent operations, you know, criminal investigation, homicides, fraud. We do it all for the Department of the Navy. And at the time this case broke, I just happened to be the assistant special agent in charge at the Washington, D.C. field office. And that's when the case broke, and I was the initial lead investigator on the case.
And since that time, you obviously have worked many other cases. You became part of the new and revised Naval Criminal Investigative Service when it was reflagged, and you've eventually retired at that time. And you've written Go ahead.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Please go ahead.
I was going to say, yes, I did retire in 1999.
And since that time, you've written a great little book called Capturing Jonathan Pollard, what you would expect, and for Naval Institute Press. What led you to write the book just real quickly before we get into the story?
Well, I didn't even have an inkling that I wanted to write this book. And this was after I retired. And this went on for years. And then I started going through things, seeing spies getting caught here and there. And, you know, every spy that has been caught in the history of our country, they all have their own story. And in going back and doing research on other spies, I realized that, wait a minute, the spy story about Jonathan Pollard is so unusual, so unique, and it is exactly what can happen when rules, regulations, policies, and procedures are misinterpreted, misunderstood, or just ignored. And I thought, you know what? This is a story. It needs to be told. It's just as fresh today as it was way back when. There have been spies since the beginning of time, and this is a spy case that needed to be told to the American public so they can understand who Jonathan Pollard is, what was he, and the incredible damage that he committed and done to our national security. It was devastating at that time. So I decided, you know, I have to tell this story.
And with that, and with no further ado, let's answer that basic question. Who and what was Jonathan Pollard when he came on the scene here in Washington, D.C.? In other words, what was his background? Who was he, and why was he here?
Okay, well, starting with his background, Jonathan Pollard, in my opinion, he always wanted to be a spy from the very beginning. I mean, he had a James Bond complex that was over the roof. And just to give you a little example of how long he went back with this, he was in Stanford University. And he was telling his roommates and stuff that he was part of the Israeli Mossad, that the they were paying his tuition in school, that his father was a CIA agent in South Africa. He was the station chief down there. He was going into all of these stories about all of these things that was it was he lived in a fantasy world, is what he did. And so much so that one time, and this is a good story, one time he brought a gun into the college room, into the dorm, and he's waving this gun around, yelling that everybody's out to get him. Now, I'm talking about this wasn't a fake gun. This was a real gun. So when we finally, when this case started, we were doing interviews after it was after his arrest and that, you know, we're asking him, Jay, what was this all about with this gun incident in Stanford University? And he said, that's sort of my fault. He said, I was eating hallucinogenic mushrooms, and I had mononucleosis, and it just sort of went a little crazy. That was his reason.
So in addition to malignant narcissism and a few other problems, he appears to have had some psychotropic drug problems as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that didn't stop there, by the way. We can get into that later. But it's funny because then, you know, when this case was over, you know, we interviewed everybody, including the professor at the college, right? And he told us that, you know, Pollard, he called Pollard a temperamental genius. He looked at Pollard as being some kind of a gifted person because Pollard was intelligent, but he was also a fantasizer that lived in the twilight zone, you speak. But this professor said he was somebody who worked at his own pace. You know, he would respond to people, but the only time he would respond to people if he felt that they were of equal intelligence with him. If they weren't at his level, he didn't want anything to do with you.
So what we've got is Walter Mitty on magic mushrooms.
Exactly.
Okay. And, of course, in one of the more ironic bents of the situation, he actually does go to work for the Central Intelligence Agency as a clerk when he was a teenager and had a family connection through his father with the agency. Talk about that.
Well, you know, when he was at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy in Boston, he sees this article in the paper that the CIA is hiring. And so with his James Bond mentality, he saw, wow, I can be a real James Bond. I'm going to quit college. He was going for his master's degree. He only had to do a couple more papers. He didn't finish them. That's how excited he was about going to work for the CIA. He goes to work for the CIA, or he tries to. So one of the things, of course, that needs to be done when you work for the CIA is you have to take a polygraph, and they do an extensive background investigation. So if you can picture this, this is how I picture what happened. You have this polygraph operator of CIA sitting in this room with his glasses on down at the front of his nose, looking at the charts, talking to Pollard about have you ever done this or that. Well, Pollard never knew what classified information was. The only thing he knew about classified information was what he saw in James Bond's movies, and that was it. He had no clue about it. So they started asking him about that. He passed all those questions correctly. You know, have you ever compromised classified information? Well, of course he didn't. But then it got around to the use of, have you ever used illegal drugs? And Pollard says, I experimented with drugs. He said, I went to Stanford University. Come on. You know, yeah, I did a little drugs. So the polygraph operator asked him, well, Jay, just give me an example. Give me an example. How many times do you think that you experimented with marijuana? He thinks about it and he says, around 600 times. And he says, I also used hashish and Thai sticks, so I don't know, 70, 80 times. Well, needless to say, that didn't go over real well with the CIA. They also found out that he told 9 foreign nationals that he was applying for the CIA. Well, needless to say, he was not hired. They didn't hire
him. The agency obviously values discretion, and he clearly had none.
Oh, not only none. I mean, he was like, forget about it. The really sad part of this story, even though, you know, it's ridiculous what he did and, you know, 600 times and that, the sad part of the story is this. When he joined the Naval Intelligence Support Center, the Defense Investigative Service is what they were called at the time, did a background investigation on them. Well, when they contacted the CIA and asked them, hey, what do you have anything, because they do you have anything on Jonathan Pollard? You know, and the DIS did this with the State Department, the FBI, you know, all the agencies. But when it got to the CIA and they asked them that question, the CIA tells the Defense Investigative Service that they never heard of him. Now, this is a guy who is about to receive a top secret, sensitive, compartmented information classified program.
Yeah.
And the CIA... The CIA is lying to the Defense Investigative Service. And what happens as a result? He gets hired on.
So in spite of his obvious, shall we say, shortcomings, he winds up becoming an analyst at Naval Intelligence in Suitland, Maryland.
That's correct.
And what does he do there?
Well, he was his job was to at the beginning, he was doing work on Soviet merchant ships traversing the South Atlantic there, and he had a friend from South Africa, and he was interested in South Africa. His job was the Caribbean, but he wanted to go after South Africa. And he approached a deputy who was a civilian at the Naval Intelligence Support Center there one evening after work and gave a story to this person about what he wanted to do. And the story was that, now, this guy, Pollard had been working for about 2 months for them. So Pollard goes to this deputy, civilian, and says, listen, I have a plan. I want to do a back channel collection operation against South African government. And this guy is just looking at him and listening to this, saying, "What are you talking about?" He says, "The CIA. My dad worked for the CIA. He was a station chief in South Africa. I know some South Africans, and." I know that I want to start a back-channel collection operation," is what he called it, exactly. So if you can imagine now, the civilians listening to him, not saying hardly anything. Pollard finishes the story, and the next day the deputy walks in to the CO's office and tells him the story about Pollard. Now, you know, he's on probation. He's not a full-time employee yet. And he tells him that Pollard is a problem employee and a potential serious security risk. And he told him the story about what Pollard was saying. And he said, we need to get rid of this guy now because it's not going to be good. He's a problem employee, and he has potential security problems that come back on us. To make a long story short, it was decided by the powers to be to give him another chance, not once or twice, but three times. So he stayed with the command, and he eventually then was transferred to a task force called, at the time it was Task Force 168, which was like a human collection intelligence group, which no longer exists, that targeted foreign hostile governments.
Now, it's worth noting that this civilian deputy who had the common sense to go ahead and realize what Pollard probably was someone that would pop up again in this story a couple of times, a gentleman by the name of Rich Haver, correct?
That is correct.
And we will not ruin the story because it just gets better and better, but Rich Haver is kind of the steady, calm, clear-eyed guy throughout all of this,
amongst a community of people who just did not see Pollard for what he was.
No, that's absolutely right. They just didn't see it at all. And that's how he got away with so much.
And this crazy idea of going and doing a back channel collection didn't go away. As a matter of fact, Pollard actually managed to go and get in front of Admiral Shapiro, the chief of naval intelligence at the time, and actually got to pitch it at one point.
Yes, I mean, when he was assigned to Task Force 168, you know, nothing that anybody did with Pollard was fast enough. When he came up with an idea, he wanted it done. He wanted it done right now. Well, it takes time to work operations, to build the operation up before it's even implemented, and it has to be approved by all of these levels. Well, Pollard was going crazy, and that's how he got in with Admiral Shapiro. He said, well, now here's a guy, again, he's only been on less than a year, and he's telling the supervisor at 168, I need to talk to the three-star, the director of Naval Intelligence. I need to talk to him. Can you imagine somebody wet behind the ears wanting to go into a three-star admiral and tell him what's going on? Well,
let's just say an old friend of mine, Tom Clancy, who I worked with for some years, kind of wrote a few stories like that about a young analyst named Jack Ryan. But let's face it, Jack Ryan was always a tad more respectful and talented than Jonathan Walker, to say the least.
Yes. And so, you know, this case is just one incident after another that Pollard got away with. I mean, you know, this guy with no credentials whatsoever gets an audience with the Director of Naval Intelligence. And he tells this admiral, and the admiral now has, in this meeting, there's two CIA agents, there's his chief of staff, the admiral, and Pollard. So Pollard goes through this whole story about he wants to recruit from South Africa and that, and when he walks out of that door, and I talked to Admiral Shapiro about this meeting, and he told me, he said, he looked around the room, and literally he said, gentlemen, we have a kook on our hands. That's quote. He honestly believed, and rightfully so, that his organization could have possibly been infiltrated by South Africa. So he is beside himself. If you can imagine, you know, here you have the Director of Naval Intelligence thinking that, oh my goodness, we might have a spy here. So the first thing he does is reduces Pollard's clearance from top secret SCI to secret. And then it goes on from there.
Now, Pollard was never one to accept the reality of his situation very well, and literally uses all of the civil service tactics available to him to go and, one, strike back at those who want to get rid of him, and at the same time get his clearance back. He eventually gets back his TSSCI clearance, correct?
Yeah, he gets it back, but he had to go through the hoops to get this, which is another crazy story, because after Pollard walked out and the DNI reduced his clearance, he called the assistant director for counterintelligence at NIS at the time, told him the story. So the assistant director says, this guy wants to be a spy, huh? He says, well, I'm going to tell you what we're going to do with Jonathan Pollard. He was working for Task Force 168. We are going to get him out of Task Force 168 and do a sham operation against him and tell him that we are going to make him a double agent targeting him against foreign governments, hostile foreign governments. And the DNI agreed with it, said, okay, go for it. So one of the things you have to do when we recruit double agents is give them a polygraph. So,
and we know how good he did on his last one.
Yeah, he didn't do good at all. And the last thing he ever wanted was to sit through a polygraph exam again. So at about 5 o'clock in the evening at the Hilton Inn at Highway 95 and Springfield, we had one of our agents in counterintelligence have Pollard meet him in a room. There was an adjoining door there, and Pollard came in. He gave him the form, sat him down, said, you're going to be a double agent. You have to sign this form, non-disclosure agreement. You know, if you get any money from hostile countries, you need to turn it over, all this kind of stuff. And then he says, oh, by the way, there's one more thing you need to do, and that's take a polygraph test. Now, the polygraph operator was in the next room. Now, the division head for counterintelligence decided that not to tell the polygraph operator that this was a sham operation. So the polygraph operator didn't know. He thought this was a regular recruitment for a double agent. So he's introduced to the polygraph operator. It starts at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And Pollard now, knowing that he had been on the test, the polygraph for the CIA, and that really didn't go well, this one here really, really, really did not go well. Pollard was so emotionally unstable, and I know the guy that gave Pollard the polygraph, and he told me, he said he was all over the charts. He had to get up. He was throwing up in the bathroom. He had diarrhea. And, you know, the polygraph officer tells me, he said to Pollard, he said, Pollard, stop. Stop right now. This is you don't have to do this operation. Just leave. Just leave. Pollard's like, oh, no. Oh, no. I'm going to get through this. I'm going to be a double agent. Well, anyway, the bottom line was this. From 5 o'clock in the afternoon, this thing didn't end until 3 o'clock in the morning.
Went on for 10 hours.
10 hours. And in the meantime, this is what Pollard admitted to. He admitted to prior drug use, which he didn't put on his application when he hired on with the Navy. You know, he told the CIA. He didn't tell the Navy that he had used drugs. He made false statements on his background. He told them that he had a master's degree. He didn't have a master's degree because, if you recall, he quit college, wanted to go to work for the CIA. He made false statements on his background about his language capabilities and everything else. He admitted to unauthorized contact with a foreign agent, and that was the guy from the South African embassy. And it was a mess. And Pollard was able to wiggle his way out of that eventually. The polygraph operator told me he wrote up a report, said Pollard needs to be fired immediately. If not, he absolutely, 100%, needs psychological counseling and evaluation. And this is the official report. So when I was hearing all this, I'm thinking, here you have this guy who couldn't pass the polygraph, came in on all of these things, and we're going to give him a psychological evaluation. Well, that's what he got. He received a psychological evaluation because the command said, you have to go through this. We want you to go to one of the psychologists at Bethesda Naval Hospital and come back when you're finished. Well, Pollard's not going to do that. He calls his father and said, Dad, they want me to take I have to get some psychological counseling, you know. Do you know anybody? So his father said, sure. So his dad had a friend who was a psychologist, and Pollard goes up there, talks to the psychologist. Psychologist says, hey, he writes out a letter for the CO of the command and says that Pollard is not a security threat. He is in sound health. There is nothing wrong with him. So the command gets this letter. And they tell Pollard, well, wait a minute. You need to go to a Navy doctor. We're not going to accept the civilian psychologist's report. So he goes to a Navy doctor at Bethesda Hospital who also does an evaluation of him, a thorough evaluation of him. And he writes up a report. So his report states, and I'm just paraphrasing here, that Jonathan Pollard does have problems, and he absolutely needs to go to counseling on a regular schedule. However, he puts in there that Jonathan Pollard is not a security risk to the United States of America. Period. So what happens? He gets away with it. He's hired back on. Not only does he get away with it, you know, his probation period ends. The evaluation is finished. He's showing his commander about the evaluation and everything. And the command feels that if they try to get rid of him, because now they had waited too long and the year had passed, and now it's September of 1980, a year after he hired on, and they can't fire him anymore. They can't fire him anymore. So what do they do? What do you do with someone who's like this? And this is one of the sad parts, too. He was hired on as a GS-7 in December of, that was in 1979. In December of 1980, guess what? They promoted him to GS-9.
And welcome to government service.
Yep. It was crazy.
And well, and just to make it even more absurd, they ship him to New York. And this is where the story really gets twisted.
Well, now that they didn't ship him to New York, but there was a guy in New York who was a friend of Jonathan Pollard's, okay? And we're going to get into now how he got started in this spy business, so to speak.
Because he was actively recruited. He recruited himself for it, amazingly enough.
He recruited himself. And what happened was his father, Morris Pollard, who has since been deceased, he had a friend in New York, and Pollard's father and this individual's father were very close together. And they both had sons, and Pollard was the same age as him. So they would talk back and forth. This guy was in New York. So Pollard's talking to him one day, and his friend said, listen, let me tell you something. I was in an auditorium, and there was a guy there who was from Israel, and he was a colonel in the Israeli Air Force. And this guy was sharp. He led the Six-Day War. He took out the Iraqi nuclear facility, and he was the head guy in the Israeli Air Force. He said, would you like to meet him? When Pollard heard that, and this is what Pollard told me later on after the Iraq, when Pollard heard what this guy had to say, he said, absolutely. And he gave the guy his telephone number. He said, have him call me. Pollard was elated. It was at that time he thought, now is my chance. I am going to spy for Israel. Well, he had a girlfriend, and his girlfriend was named Ann Henderson, and he was living with her in a little apartment. He runs home, sits down with Ann, and literally tells his girlfriend, this is what I'm going to do. Are you with me? And she said, yes, let's do it. And that's when this whole thing started.
And so he makes his mind up out of the blue, having heard about a man named, that we will come to know as, Avim Sella.
Avim Sella, yes.
Avim Sella, who was, in fact, a colonel in the Israeli Air Force, who was in the United States on an educational visa, and who, in fact, had gone and been an operational planning officer for the reactor raid in 81 and other events.
Yes.
Pollard has made up his mind. He's going to go spy for the Israelis.
Absolutely. There's no doubt in his mind. He knew that he could pull this off no matter what.
And how does he do this? How does he approach Sella?
Well, the guy had given him the telephone number. And so Sella was going to call Pollard because he said, you know, you need to talk to this guy, Pollard, because he's a very interesting individual. So Sella calls him and said, listen, I'm coming to D.C., and I'd like to meet you for lunch. So Pollard said, well, that would be great. So they set up a date and time, and that's when Pollard's wheels really started to turn. He says to his girlfriend, okay, here's what we need to do. I'm going to be passing classified information to the Israelis, and there's some times that I may not be able to make the trip to New York. So I'm going to need to recruit someone. So will you go with me while I recruit a classmate that I was with in college? Because he's very true to Israel, and I think he will help us. So Anne agrees. They drive over to this individual's house, and they walk in the door, and Pollard immediately starts belittling him and the furniture he had, because it was old and the place was a mess. And he's saying, what is wrong with you? This place is ridiculous. It's dirty. You got old furniture. You can do better than this. And then he offers a proposition. Look, here's what I'm going to do, and this is what I need you to do for me. Times come that I cannot make the delivery in New York. And so his friend said, well, how much is in it for me? And Pollard says, about $2,000 every time. Friend says, I don't know. I'm going to have to think about this. So they leave, and as they're driving home, Ann looks at Pollard. She's driving and says, Jay, I think that was a bad idea talking to him. And it was. But the guy calls Pollard the next day and said, listen, I don't want anything to do with this. Leave me out of this. I'm not going to do it. So that's a good thing. The bad thing was Pollard's telling him that he's going to be a spy for Israel, and this individual doesn't tell a soul.
In fact,
he didn't call the FBI. Said, hey, this is what happened. This guy may be kidding me. I don't know, but you need to check in on this. He never did. He never did tell anyone what occurred that night.
And this is sort of a recurring theme throughout the Pollard case. People who see things, hear things, are even directly recruited and asked if they'll help him. They may say no, but along the way, they just do nothing.
That happens time and time and time again, unfortunately, because people are afraid to get involved. They're afraid to report suspicious activity, even when the activity is direct and factual.
Needless to say, for people like you, this is not a good situation.
No, it isn't. It surely isn't.
Okay, so nevertheless, he goes forward, and eventually he sets up a system which is absurdly simple, completely against the rules, regulations, and standard practices and procedures of the Naval Intelligence Service,
talk about how they establish this drop point for him with a copy machine in him and how he begins to process that.
Well, it started like this at that Hilton Hotel on Connecticut Avenue in D.C. where he meets Sella, okay? Now, Sella is just meeting him for lunch, but he knew that he was possibly going to try to recruit Pollard. So Sella starts telling Pollard about all of his war hero experiences and that, and Pollard stops him cold turkey. And this guy never asked him a thing about, you want to work for us? Pollard says, stop. I've heard enough. Listen, I am going to work for you. I have access to NSA, DIA, all the intelligence agencies in Washington, D.C. I can get this type of material, top secret, sensitive compartment. This is in a restaurant at the Hilton Hotel. He's telling him this. So if you can imagine what Sella was doing, because Sella was not a handler of operational assets. He was on the periphery. So he really didn't know what he was doing. He thought this was a setup. He's looking around looking for the CIA, thinking in his mind, this can't be this easy. Pollard continues telling him what he's going to do, and Sella says, okay, well, at our next meet, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write Israeli letters down, like 10 different letters, and each one will coincide with a payphone that's close to your house. So the next time we meet, we're going to do that, okay? And in the meantime, I want you to get telephone numbers, you know, from the payphones in your area. And instead of Pollard saying, okay, when do you want to meet? We'll do this. You know what Pollard tells him? He says, don't move. Don't move. I will be right back. He runs out of this hotel down the hill and starts getting the phone numbers of payphones within a two-block radius. Comes back to the hotel where they were having lunch and hands the list over to him. And that's how it started. So Sella said, okay, I'm going to meet you at the park. Now Sella has to test him now because, yeah, he was talking to him. He did what he was supposed to do, Pollard, but he wanted to see if Pollard could really, really steal top secret sensitive compartment information. So he said, I want to meet you at Dumbarton Oaks, which is in Georgetown. And I want you to bring with you the damage that I did on the raid in the Iraqi nuclear facility because the Israelis would never give that to him for whatever reason. And Pollard says, oh, all right, I'll get that for you. So they made a date, and sure enough, Pollard finds the photographs of that raid in the intelligence community, gathers them up, and meets him at the park, opens his briefcase. Sella sees that. He's shocked. He keeps those photographs because the Israelis, for whatever reason, wouldn't give them to him. And his spy life begins.
Now, procedurally, he literally would go and do what? Order documents through the normal document control system at Naval Intelligence, walk out the door with them, deliver them to an apartment or other facility with a copy machine. They'd copy them, and then he'd bring them back and put them back in the system, right?
He would put them back in the system only if he had to sign out for them. So if he had something, let's say, from the NSA, which he did, like the radio notation signals manual, the Raisin manual, which at that time was one of the highest classified pieces of information that the NSA had. He literally talked a lady into giving him a copy of that manual. So he did have access. And they're giving him a copy of he had a courier card that where he could go anywhere around D.C. to any agency, and with his courier card, he had an SCI clearance card. He had a card that would prevent anyone from searching his briefcase, going in to, say, like the Defense Intelligence Agency with an empty briefcase, coming out with it full of top secret material. He could never, ever be searched, ever, because of his clearance. And
now,
his
it's worth
card.
Noting, this, at no time was there any particular tradecraft involved in this. It wasn't like he had a little Minox camera the way Walker and Ames and other people did. He was handling full-size, hard-copy documents and delivering them to the Israelis directly.
Yes. And they weren't, the Israelis weren't telling him, do this and do that. This was on Pollard's own accord, because the first meet, when he went to Ilan Ravine, who was the scientific counselor at the Israeli embassy, Sella drove Pollard to that house. He met him at a Holiday Inn. He got in the car with him. Pollard had with him two full suitcases full of top-secret information. He goes to this house in Potomac, Maryland, and Sella says, now, remember the way that I'm going here so you can find this place on your own. So he walks into this house with two, you know, most spies back in those days, they would use microchips maybe, you know, from microfilm, you know, the little spy cameras where you could, you know, develop the film and things, or a manila envelope, or passing briefcases, whether it's in the United States or in Vienna somewhere overseas. Not Pollard. Pollard wasn't going to go that route. He passed, the first time he walked in with those two suitcases. They opened the suitcases. They almost fell over. And they said, Pollard, how much money do you want for two suitcases here? We're going to copy them and give you the stuff back you need to take back to where you checked out with, but the rest of the stuff we're going to keep. So what do you want for this stuff? Pollard says, about $200,000 would be great. Well, their jaw dropped and said, whoa. Wait a minute. We can't be paying you $200,000. First of all, he said, the FBI, you know, even though they don't watch us because we're allies, if you start throwing around money like that, they're going to be on to you and you're going to get caught. So we're going to make arrangements for you to go to Paris, and we're going to introduce you to the old man being Rafi Eitan, who was an intelligence operative in Israel.
Now, he did eventually wind up getting paid about $2,500 a month for the 18 months he was active, correct?
Correct. He started at $1,500, and then he got really mad after about a year, and he said, you have to pay me more money than that, so they upped it by $1,000. So at that time, he was getting $2,500 a month for delivery.
Okay. But there's no question, there's been a lot of popular mythology about him being an ideological spy like the Cambridge Ring or the Rosenbergs. Let's make it real clear here. Jonathan Pollard was as much a spy whore as John Walker and his family in that regard, correct?
That is absolutely correct. It had nothing to do with love of Israel, or in Walker, love of the Soviet Union. It was greed. It was money, period.
And, oh, by the way, it wasn't, as you say, a love of Israel, because he was also attempting to spy for South Africa, Pakistan, Australia, and gathering information on China to help his wife's career with a company she was doing business with. I mean, this guy had no scruples when it came to spying for benefit, correct?
That is correct. Not only did he have no scruples, he had no clue of how to even try to protect himself from someone watching him. There was no counter-surveillance for him at all. He would walk out of our headquarters where he was assigned to the Anti-Terrorist Alert Center. This was in Suitland, Maryland at the time. He would walk out of our headquarters two or three times a day, three or four times a week, go to his car with briefcase, go to a park that was close to the area. Sometimes he would go to a place called Sam's Car Wash, which was close to Suitland, Maryland. He had a back seat that would fold down. He would take the papers out of his briefcase, put them in the suitcase, and he would do this, like I said, two or three times a day, three or four times a week. And that's why when he delivered suitcases, he wasn't delivering manila envelopes. He was delivering full suitcases.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break for some network announcements. But when we come back, we're going to talk about a bad weekend for Pollard and his coworkers and you getting involved in catching them. All right, let's go ahead and take a quick break.
All right.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the RightStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com, that's LISATARVES, for details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. RightStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network.
These are the sounds of someone taking their eyes off the road. Texting while driving is more than distracting. It's dangerous. Do us all a favor. When you're on the road, stay off the phone. A message from CTIA, America's Wireless Companies, and the National Safety Council.
And we're back on Military Monday with our guest, Ron Olive, former special agent for NIS and NCIS, and the man who helped capture spy Jonathan Pollard. Are you still with us here, Ron?
Yes, John, I'm here with you.
Very good. Now, this obviously goes on for a while, about a year and a half, until a very bad Friday night in November of 1985. Tell us about that Friday night and what you and I have dubbed the sleepless weekend.
Well, on that Friday night, what had happened was Pollard would order top secret material from the communications center downstairs. They all had access to that from the Anti-Terrorist Alert Center. So he ordered these documents. It's around just before 5 in the afternoon on Friday night. November 11th was Veterans Day, so that was going to be a holiday. So Pollard comes upstairs with this manila envelope in his hand with a cover sheet on it, and he starts waving this thing around. saying, oh, look at what, because the cover sheet on listed the titles of the documents that was inside the envelope. And he starts waving this thing around, yelling, you know, look what I did. You know, they gave me all the wrong documents. Now I got to go downstairs. I have to shred this stuff. Well, a coworker hears this. And Pollard used to do this all the time. Nobody paid any attention to Pollard. They just thought he was a wacko, more or less. The coworker hears this, doesn't think anything about it. You know, it's one of Pollard's rants. But he listened to what he was saying. The coworker walks out of headquarters to get in the car to wait for his wife, who worked in the next building. He's sitting in the car. Now, this car is facing the headquarters. The parking lot is right across the street. He sees now Pollard's wife, Ann, pulls up in front of headquarters, right in front of the steps. He sees Pollard bopping down the steps, and in his hand, he has the same manila envelope with that white sheet of paper on it. And he gets in his car with Ann, and they drive off. They don't drive towards the Naval Intelligence Command or, you know, none of that. They get on the highway. They turn to what they would be doing is getting on the highway. Well, this poor co-worker was beside himself. He was fretting over it. He lived about an hour away. He was talking to his wife saying, this is what I saw. I don't know what to do. You know, what if I say something to my supervisor and his supervisor said it was okay to take this? Nobody's going to trust me anymore. He went on and on like this. He was devastated on what to do. So he finally calls his supervisor, and to make a long story short, he said, listen, this is what I saw. He said, please look around and see if there's a manila envelope in a waste can or something like that. Maybe it was something else. So the commanding officer of the ATAC there, the commander, he looked around, didn't find anything. And I'll go back on the phone call for a second. When he called his commander there, he said, I'm not going to tell you the name of the guy who did this, who walked out with classified information. So the commander said, jokingly, there's always a jokester in a command, and this one guy was a jokester. And so he shouts out, now he says, I bet this was so-and-so. Well, now the co-worker's saying, oh, I got to tell him the name because this could really go bad. So he tells him the name. Co-worker searches the desk. Underneath the desk, the commander finds
stacks
of information.
Yeah, this is Pollard's desk over the weekend.
This is Pollard over the weekend. This is still Friday night. This is still Friday night, and it's all stacked up. Now, Pollard was responsible for the Caribbean and the merchant ships tracks through to South Africa. Well, nothing pertained to it. Nothing pertained to that area. It was all other information about Israelis, about all kinds of stuff on everything except what he had to deal with in his job. So he didn't think much about it. He goes home, goes to sleep, tells his wife. His wife says, well, you know, you better look into it. 3 o'clock in the morning, he can't sleep. This is Saturday. Gets up, goes back to the ATAC, the Anti-Terrorist Alert Center, goes downstairs to the communication center and said, give me everything that Pollard has requested in the last 6 months. Kid comes back to the window with a stack so high it was unbelievable. He starts going through it, and Pollard had responsibility for the Caribbean. And this was all dealt with Israel and the Middle East and all these countries all over the world. It had nothing to do with his job.
In other words, so, the printout of the things he had accessed all had to do with things other than what was going on within the Southcom area of responsibility.
That is absolutely correct. So, you know, he was beside himself. He goes and calls the assistant director for counterintelligence and said, I have to come talk to you. He goes and tells him what he found. And that Tuesday, nothing happened over that weekend. I wasn't notified. Nobody was notified. you know, you had the Veterans Day, because the commander, even though Pollard was doing stuff that he should not have been doing, still nobody knew what was going on. Nobody knew what was going on.
It looked like a case of document mishandling and some security violation.
Yes.
The word spy has not even become a conscious thought in anybody's brain yet.
Not close to it. Not even close to it. So the following week, we put a surveillance camera in, and, you know, as the Keystone cops would say, I was responsible for, you know, counterintelligence at the Washington field office. So we told headquarters we need a camera in there, and we need 24-hour surveillance on that camera by personnel. Make a list. So they did. Well, now this is going on all week, right?
And
so
you
on
have
Friday
become
night,
involved. And you have become involved by this time.
By this time, I have, because now they had surveillance on the cameras. The problem is on that. This went on all week long until Friday, and when Friday came around, Pollard put stuff in his briefcase, classified information, and walked out the door, and needless to say, we didn't find out about it until months later, because whoever from headquarters was supposed to be watching the monitor wasn't there, didn't see him walk out. So the following Monday, we find this out. Oh, this is great. So the assistant director says, we need to get in touch with the FBI. I call the FBI. I say, okay, here's what we're doing. I need about 30 of your agents in your SSG, you know, the special surveillance group, and we need to follow Pollard. We put together a classified package for him of top-secret SCI material, and we were going to have surveillance. I thought, this is great. When I call the FBI and say, okay, I need at least 20 FBI agents because all of my agents were on a protective service detail for Yosef Rabin, who was in town for a week. So I only had one agent left. I said, I need 30 agents. They said, we can give you two, me and somebody else. So I'm like, okay, wait a minute. So you can only give me two people, you and one other person? I said, what are you going to do if Pollard's driving through D.C. traffic, walks into an apartment building with top-secret SCI material, and walks out without the package? Can you get authority to search every apartment in that big building? Well, no. Well, that's not working. So I told the assistant director, I said, we just need to bring Pollard in. We brought him in. That Monday evening when he walked out with the package, Pollard, we have to talk to you. I stayed out of it. My agent, Lisa, was in the room, interrogation room, along with the two FBI agents. This went on from 5 o'clock in the evening till 10:30 at night. Pollard's not coming in on anything. The FBI keeps telling me they're leaving. I keep telling them, this is from 5 o'clock till 10. I keep telling them, no, you're not. No, you're not. We have to find out what he was doing with those classified documents. One thing led to another. They call their supervisor. The supervisor says, you come home in 30 minutes. It's the FBI.
Now, in deference to our friends in the Federal Bureau of Investigation, this was a kind of a busy time right at the moment for the simple fact that this was not the first or even the second mole hunt that was going on. In fact, you didn't even know it was a mole hunt yet, because several other spy investigations were highly active, including the Howard case that will come back and bite you on the tail in just a matter of a short time. So please, continue on with your story of trying to hang on to these two agents from the FBI.
Yeah, it was crazy. And finally, Pollard comes around the corner, and when I was at the headquarters, the ATAC was right around the corner. I didn't know Pollard. Well, he came in one time and tried to befriend me, you know, about a South African guy who he could get intelligence information on. So I said, I didn't know who he was, and I said, well, if you can make a, you know, we can make a beat somewhere, you know, I might be willing to do that. But nothing came of it. So I wasn't going to get involved in this thing. But he comes around the corner, and now it's going on 11 o'clock, and I stop him, and I just say, Jay, I said, listen, we need to get on with our business. We need to search your apartment. You need to give us a permissive search, because he wouldn't give one the entire time they've been talking to him. He refused. And he said, he didn't say anything. He just turned around and walked away. And to redress just a little bit, my agent came out at one time and told me that Pollard had made a call, wanted to make a call to his wife. And he made a call to his wife and saying, honey, I'm going to be late. Take the cactus bought for the birthday for the people next door and just take it over there and I'll be home later. Hangs up, said, oh, I forgot something. Can I call again? She said, yeah. This is when the FBI is out of the room. He said, oh, honey, don't forget the wedding album. Well, the wedding album meant the classified material that's still in the house, and the cactus plant meant the rest of the material that's in the house that he had hidden somewhere else. The day before, this is on Monday now, and the day before on Sunday, Pollard told his wife that if I ever use the word cactus in any content, you know I'm in trouble. Get rid of the classified information. My agent comes out and said, Ron, he used this word. This is where women's intuition comes in as far as I'm concerned. She comes out and she says, you know, he used this word cactus. He said, she said, Ron, it sounded, it could have been a code word. And I said, you know what, Lisa? I said, you could be right. Get good notes on everything he said. So anyway, we go over there. Yeah, FBI goes over there. He's got 57 secret, no foreign. He's got 13 top secret SCI material in his apartment. The FBI said, this is nothing but a absent-minded professor, throws the documents on me and say, we're out of here. This case is over for us. I said, okay. Pollard calls me. I said, before I left, I said, Jay, I'll call him Jay. Jay, I need you to take a polygraph tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Long story short, he doesn't show up at 10. 11 o'clock, he doesn't show up. I call him. What are you doing, Jay? I can't make it, he says. I've got a stomach ache. I was up late. I said, I was up late, too. 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I go home, get an hour's sleep. I came back. You got to come in here and take this polygraph. I know you can pass it. You know you can pass it. Well, that wasn't true, but he did come in. I sent my agents for him, and he came in, and that's when he said he had to talk to me first before he takes a polygraph. And that's when he came in on his story of espionage.
And this is, of course, up till now, we're talking violations of security, mishandling of documents, not unserious things, but, you know, things that threaten your job. All of a sudden, the word spying and espionage come up, and you haven't gotten any sleep since this thing got handed to you. Where
No.
is your head right at that moment?
Well, when he was saying that he wasn't going to come in, my head was spinning because I knew that that could not happen. And whatever I needed to do to make that happen, it was going to happen. I mean, I like I said, I told him, I said, listen, I know you can pass this test. You have to come in here. And everything's, oh, then I said, you know, you can then go back to work, and I can go back to work. Well, I knew that was a lie because he wasn't going anywhere. We already had classified information, so he was never going to work again for the government. But I wasn't going
to
tell him that. I said, you're going
to
go back to work.
You're trying to play good cop with the guy to get him to open up, obviously.
Exactly. And I think the Supreme Court said you can do that. You know, you can fit to a suspect.
forgive me, sir, as we say in California where I'm from, duh, yes, you can lie to us.
So anyway, that's who he came in on it, and the FBI now was back in the case.
Because all you have to do is say the word espionage, and they're back like flies on excrement, obviously.
Yeah, I interviewed him for 3 hours before I called them, you know, and that was quite a scene. He'd start lying to me, and I'd tell him, you know, you're lying. I can tell you're lying. And then he changed the story, and one thing led to another. But in the end, after 3 hours, he had told me everything, how much money he was getting, how long he had been doing it. The only thing he would not tell me, well, he told me it was a CBS reporter that he was giving these documents to. I didn't believe that, but 3 hours had passed. It's going on 5 o'clock. I have to advise the assistant director what's happening here and to get this show on the road. And so he came back in the next day, but it was quite an episode.
And now we get to the fun part. I mean, the part where the Keystone Cops metaphor really takes off. Because during that search that you were talking about of his apartment, Anne had gone and had taken one huge bag, 70 pounds worth, and hidden it, and had seen what she thought was an FBI surveillance operation outside of her apartment, correct?
Oh, yes. That was another, you know, there's so many crazy things that happened in this case. I mean, this case was literally a whirlwind. I mean, there wasn't time to rest. There wasn't time to do anything. I mean, it was like, holy mackerel, what has happened? You know, most espionage cases, like you said earlier, you know, they go for a year, sometimes 6 years, sometimes they're never resolved. This was just like a whirlwind. But when Pollard told her and gave her the code word cactus, she drags a 70-pound suitcase down 3 flights of stairs at their apartment, looks down the street, sees a white car with 2 guys in suits and black tires. And Jonathan told her, if you ever see a car like that with guys with suits and black tires, they're FBI. She looks down the alley, there's the FBI car, which she believes is FBI, which turned out, yes, it really was the FBI. But they didn't have a clue who the Pollards were. They didn't have a clue who the Pollards were. So she's got this 70-pound suitcase, and she's petite, so she's got to pull it bouncing down 3 flights of stairs, sees the FBI, panics, pulls it into the apartment, first floor, under the stairwell, runs up to her neighbor, knocks on the door. In a panic, she tells the neighbor, listen, Jay had classified material. We were going to burn it, and he didn't have a chance, and the FBI is watching us, and I need somebody to take this suitcase to the Four Seasons Hotel in the lobby, and I'll meet him there. And so this poor lady is like, Anne, come on in. Have a drink. Calm down, will you? She said, no, I can't. I got to get going. So from the back room comes her husband, who is an exchange student from Iran, and said, honey, what's going on? Tells her the story. Suitcase she wants to take here is full of classified information. He says, I'll take it. So he does. He takes the suitcase of the Four Seasons. He turned out to be a really good guy. She doesn't show up. She's meeting Avian Sella at the time in a panic, who was in town, meets him. She said, the only thing he told her was, if they ask you anything, you don't know me, you don't know my name, you don't know where I'm from, you know, do you want to go with me back to Israel? She says, no, I got to stay here with Pollard. Whole thing was crazy. So they kept the suitcase in the, it's funny, I don't know why they put it in the bathtub, but it comes to find out that her father was a naval officer in Virginia. She calls her dad the next day and says, Daddy, you know, told her the story, and he said, you need to call NIS right now. So that's what got this whole thing going.
And, of course, that was a FBI surveillance vehicle, except they were surveilling the Howard case, the Edward Lee Howard case. I mean,
no, it wasn't Howard. It was Ron Pelton.
Oh, it was
Who was
Pelton,
at his
okay.
girlfriend's house that was only 2 blocks away. The FBI had that house surrounded.
And so you guys are literally tripping over each other, trying to run down
and
your spies.
Even, Well, we weren't driven over each other, but I don't know. We didn't find that out until later. You know, the Bureau never did tell us that, oh, well, we got another case going on right over there. They're not going to tell me that. But, yeah, that was funny. You know, in 1985, 10 people were arrested for espionage. And there would be four more before the end of the year. And two of them were Pollard. The other one was Pelton, and the one that made up number 14 was Larry Wu Tai Chin. Edward Howard escaped to Russia, if you recall, and then committed suicide by jumping off a balcony in a big apartment building.
Let's hear it for gravity. Okay, now.
And instant justice.
I'm all for gravity and justice. Now, let's go and wrap this up because you finally do get him to admit what he's doing, but there is a slow speed car chase through the streets of Georgetown and along the north shore of the Potomac beforehand. So run that story down and we'll finish this up.
Okay. Once this thing broke and I brought and Pollard confessed to me, well, now the FBI was on top of it. They were following surveillance. They had surveillance on him. He couldn't go anywhere. His wife packs a suitcase. They get in the car. The FBI is on surveillance. They are on him. She had to get a little procedure done at a hospital. They don't know what's going on. Nobody did. She goes upstairs with the suitcase, her and Jay, and they think she's going to check in. She didn't. They come back down. They get in the car. FBI is following them. They're not going back home. They don't know where they're at because they had never been in this area in Georgetown. You know, most of the embassies are in Washington, D.C. At that time, the Israeli embassy was in Georgetown on a lot there. And now they have a lot of embassies next to the Israelis, but then there wasn't. And so the FBI has no clue where he's going. So he pulls by the embassy, and unbeknownst to the FBI or to us, Pollard had called the security officer at the Israeli embassy, told him who he was, told him he's coming in. Security officer says, if you can break FBI surveillance, we'll open the gate for you. They open the gate for him. The FBI pulls up, screeching. The gate slams shut in front of the embassy. He goes down the thing. A friend of mine with the Bureau jumps out. What is this place? What is this? They tell him the Israeli embassy, and everybody's jaw drops. I bet 1,000 phone calls went out that Pollard and Ann just ran to the Israeli embassy, you know. It was crazy. So the ambassador for the Israeli embassy wasn't there. The deputy was. And if you can imagine this, within about 20 minutes, imagine the deputy of the ambassador in the Israeli embassy looking out the window and seeing about 50 cars and 100 agents surrounding the Israeli embassy. He called downstairs and said, get them out of here now. And so they did. They said, Jay, you got to leave. And he was arrested. As soon as he got out of there, a friend of mine who handcuffed him, pulled him out of the car, handcuffed him, put him in the back seat. And instead of being humble, maybe crying, you've just been arrested for espionage. And you know what his attitude was? Cocky as can be. He tells my friend, you blew it. You stupid, you blew it. You thought this was some other kind of operation. You didn't have a clue. You are stupid. That's the way he's talking. Instead of, not realizing that he's going to jail, that's Pollard's attitude. That's the way he is. And to tell you the truth, as many years have gone by, he'll be out of jail on November 21st, 2015. I don't think he's changed a bit.
Now, you had still one last task, which was to break him. You had to interrogate and get a confession out of him. And you did that. Describe that final interrogation, if you will.
Well, the interrogation, I wanted to verify for sure because he did blame it on a CBS news reporter. And I said, that was a lie, and you know it, right? I said, that was Israel, wasn't it? And he shakes his head, yes. And so he is now telling us the whole story. He told the whole story what he told me when I interviewed him before. I mean, everything turned out to be the truth except the CBS News reporter. So now he is talking freely. He is under arrest. And, you know, I'm not diminishing the FBI. They're great. I have so many good friends with the Bureau. So I don't want them to get upset. But we're at the FBI office, and they're talking. We're talking to him, myself and another agent. And the door knocks, and it's two agents. And this is what really aggravated me to death. They said, well, it's 2:30. We have to get Pollard arraigned by 3 o'clock this afternoon. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, we are in an interrogation here. This individual has waived his rights. He's initialed everything, signed the rights form. He's talking freely. He's voluntarily doing this, and you want us to stop so you can arraign him? I said, arraign him in the morning. Oh, no. Our rules are that they have to be arraigned right after they're arrested, and we only got a half an hour because the court closes at 3. I just said, you got to be kidding me. Walked back in the room, told the agent what was going on, and they took Pollard away, and that was the last time I saw him until he was in court, federal court, being sentenced.
And let us make this clear. The volume of material he took out is genuinely astounding. Now, someone we mentioned earlier, Rich Haver, got stuck with one of those tough jobs that's called the damage assessment. In other words,
correct,
he had to sit down and try and get an inventory not only of what Pollard had taken out, but also some sense of the variety, the depth, and the volume of what he'd taken out. And it was a little astounding. I mean, try and give a sense of the cubic volume of what he had taken out in 18 months of operations.
Well, and I talked to Rich Haver about this. You know, he was a friend. And when he finished his damage assessment, he told me that if Pollard wouldn't have pled guilty and went to court, he said he could prove in a federal court that Jonathan Pollard stole 360 cubic feet. It would fill a room 6 foot high, 6 foot wide, and 10 feet deep. Now, you got to remember, this wasn't the age of the chips like the Snowdens and the Bannings and stuff. This was hard paper copy. That's how much he stole in 18 months. And we're not talking about confidential or secret material here. We're talking top secret stuff that went to the state of Israel. And
now, and that breaks out at about 20 cubic feet of documents every month that he was taken out the front door.
That's absolutely correct. And when Haver went down to visit him when he finished his damage assessment and talked to Pollard in Petersburg prison where he's being held until trial, and he told Pollard what he had come up with. And you know what Pollard said when he said, so what do you have to say about this many documents? Pollard says, yeah, that's just about right. And let me tell you what else Pollard told us. This was his attitude. He literally, and this is, I would say this is in quotes. I don't have it in front of me, but he said, if I could see it and I could touch it, you can assume I got it. The only thing that kept me from getting more was the physical ability to carry the document.
Needless to say, this was irritating to people like Caspar Weinberger and John Layman, who were the Secretary of Defense and the Navy, respectively, at that time. And he's been in prison ever since.
What is your feeling, you know, personally, having worked on this case and having gone through all the trouble of working on him, what are your feelings about him now some years later, especially as sometime in the next few years he will probably be paroled or released?
Yeah, and that's by I don't think he should be released until his 30 years is up, and that's mandatory that he will be released at that time. Probably one of the most though upsetting things to me is the amount of people within our government who, in my opinion, maybe I shouldn't say this, but in my opinion, don't really have a clue as to who Jonathan Pollard was and what he really did and the devastating damage that he caused. It's like all the politicians have forgotten about that. And that's sad to me.
Ron,
they
I
want
to thank
you
for coming on today and telling your story. And to our listeners, I want to say, if you want to hear, if you want to get all the facts on this and take a look at it, you should go to U.S. Naval Institute Press, their website, or Amazon, and look for the book Capturing Jonathan Pollard by Ronald Olive. And, Ron, I want to thank you for coming on and telling your story today.
Well, thank you for having me, John. It was a real pleasure. And I thank you for taking the time to let me tell this story.
Listen, I'm going to say it again because our good friend Norman Pulmar says, you need to write more books and tell more stories, sir.
Yeah, I hear you. Tell Norman I hear him. I hear him.
And when you do, come back on. We'd love to have you. Thank you for your time, sir.
All right. Thank you, John. Bye.
Take care, Ron. And with that, we've come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. Thank you for letting us tell these stories. Thank you for letting us bring on good people who don't do it in five-minute segments. I hope you'll be back with us next week. And this is John Gresham signing off again for Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. Cry. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man, and now I'm out in the cold. What's a song? My face. There's a baby on the doorstep wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep who gives his life to take. A flare through a pawn shop, a flare through a pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying.